And thank you all today on this beautiful day for turning up to our last midday monthly military history presentation. And those of you who were there last night for Ian McGibbon's talk on the 70 years of the Korean War, it was a very interesting presentation. And those that didn't make it, sorry, you missed out on a good one. But given the fact that yesterday was Armistice Day, and so we were commemorating the 101st anniversary of Remembrance Day, as well as an opportunity on the 70th anniversary of New Zealand's involvement in the Korean War. Well, to finish up presentations today, we thought it was most appropriate to introduce us to the next celebration here in Palmerston North, and that's the 150th anniversary, or sesquicentennial. And so to do that, we've got Professor Margaret Tennant, who is a well-known local historian, or not only local, is it, Margaret, to talk about her most recent production, known as City of the Centre. I'll let Margaret tell us a little bit more about that. And then following that, Leanne Hickman, also another local historian, is going to talk to us about the military history of Palmerston North, which is also quite an interesting topic. Now, both of these presentations will be recorded, and we'll upload both the PowerPoint presentations and the audio recordings onto our engineer website, where we've got all the other recordings that we've managed to do this year. So if any colleagues you think might be interested, this information is freely accessible and available on there if they want, if they missed the presentation, or if they want to go back and have a look at it or listen to it again. So without further ado, please welcome Margaret Tennant.
Kia ora koutou. Thanks to you for coming, because I know many of you have been to a number of lectures during the week and obviously last night as well. So what I'm going to talk about is our thematic history of Palmerston North and themes coming up there. A chapter, of course, on Tangata Whenua, environment, the expansion of the city, the works of people working in the city, politics of the city, education in Palmerston North, and of course for a while they claimed that label Knowledge City, sport and leisure, which Geoff Watson did, the idea of the organised city, or the groups that came together, and that would include of course groups like the RSA, and then a conclusion which gives draws these themes together and gives a chronological overview. It's got multiple authors, and it had three of us editing it. So although Joe referred to my book, in fact, it's a book that's owned by a group of people. What you don't see there, and if we ever did do a second volume, is a chapter entitled The City at War. But there is mention throughout, and there's various threads throughout the book that refer both to wartime and to what we might call military history, war history, ways in which the city engaged with the notion of conflict. So some of the threads in the current book, the what we might call wartime tales, the chapter on Tangata Whenua has quite a lot on Rangitane battles past and the conflicts that they engaged in to claim this label as of Tangata Whenua. So many of you will be aware of some of the labelling along the riverbank and the sites that we've become aware of in a way that we perhaps weren't aware of until the last 5 years, where Rangitane fought battles and where their dead lie. There's also mention as an example of Māori engagement with World War I and World War II, but particularly World War II, Rangi Mawhete, better known as William Moffat, known by his English name, who was involved with the Māori War Effort Organisation and who lost a son in the Second World War. There's also mention of the Māori Battalion training in Palmerston North and the Māori Battalion Hall and its history. I'll show an image shortly of how even a chapter on environment has an element of engagement with the war history of the city. Memorial Park was established as a memorial to those who had died in war at the end of the Second World War. It was previously a railway gravel pit where they excavated ballast or gravel for the railways. But it was established as a memorial park with, and I'll show you soon the image, with a plinth that memorialised those who died in war, which was eventually removed when it fell into disrepair, and it was realised that Anzac Day and occasions like that were basically being celebrated in Te Marae or Hine, the square. City at Work. One of the points made in the chapter Building the City, yes, the Hokapiru Transit Camp, because one of the effects of war is a housing shortage and the need for temporary housing, both for migrants from the United Kingdom and for New Zealand families and the families of returned servicemen who were unable to find housing. You know, housing shortages aren't just a phenomenon of the present. There's also mention of the city's expansion out to Linton and how the army camp becomes much more a part of the city, quite in a political as well as a physical sense. City at Work, the importance of public sector employment to Palmerston North. Palmerston North had a very, very high percentage of its population in recent years engaged in public sector employment, and that includes employment at the army camp. Linton Camp and features in the work chapter, as does the Māori workforce, and I think the 2016 figure on the City Council website is something like 30%, and correct me somebody, but about 30% of the workforce at Linton Camp is of Māori origin, which is very high in terms of workplace figures. Politics. There's quite a bit there about the leadership role of mayors in wartime, and particularly James Nash and Augustus Mansfield, who invariably, it was the mayor who led the patriotic effort, was often chair of the Patriotic Society, and in Mansfield's case of the emergency precaution scheme. So we mentioned the role of leadership, civilian leadership in wartime. And in education, two lenses there. One is mostly relating to World War II and the way that schools, and particularly the newly built intermediate normal, was taken over for military purposes. And then there is an image showing student protest against the Vietnam War. The chapter on organisations has got probably the most mention of a city at war, because it discusses both the First and the Second World War, the effect of engagement in wartime activity, both men going off to fight, but also the counter-attraction of patriotic societies often led to a decline in membership in some organisations, and particularly men's organisations, going into abeyance. Temporarily or permanently in some cases. So groups like the Savage Club, formed to entertain, couldn't sustain their activities in wartime because many of their members went overseas to fight. Patriotic societies, of course, feature a lot in the chapter, both those associated with both wars, and the intense community engagement and patriotic activity is really important in the chapter on organisations. There's also an interesting effect of how, and perhaps more in both wars really, the Scandinavian society in the First World War reasserts it revitalises when different ethnic groups find that their communities overseas are under siege and as a result of being invaded or whatever, they tend to reform, and the diaspora that around the world tends to reform, and you get this assertion of ethnic identity in the places that where they've moved to. Like in World War II, the Chinese Association dates back to 1937 when China was being invaded by the Japanese. But we also mention the Home Guard and other kinds of wartime organisation, and some that are formed as a result of war but after the war, like the Overseas Ladies Club, which was dominated by the wives of returned servicemen who had married overseas and whose wives came back and were called the overseas ladies, and to give them support in their new environment, for them to learn about things like what bring a plate means. This association was formed to help them acclimatise in a new society, in their new environment. So images in the book are part of the story. So sometimes even when we didn't talk about wartime activity in the words, we have for image with a substantial caption. So on the left, the Women's Land Army marching. I think it was one of those occasions where a battle had been won. I don't think it was VE Day or VJ Day. I may be wrong there, but it was the idea there was to give the effect of the militarisation of society beyond the actual army corps, and how everyone wanted to wear uniforms. So the local Red Cross, for example, it had women wearing, you'll see photos of women in nurses' uniforms working at the public hospital, but you'll also see them in a newly designed military uniform, and they had commandants and a sort of parallel kind of military structure even within a an organisation that was supposedly neutral in terms of its international mandate. On the right is the memorial I mentioned before at Memorial Park, which I think was about 1952. You can put me right on this, Leanne. Founded Plinth, founded as a memorial to those who died in war, fell into disrepair, and I think it was pulled down in the 1980s. Yeah. I'm sorry?
75,
was it?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. You can the RSA was approached to support it, and the city was approached to support it, but nobody would come forward at that time during the Vietnam War, so it was a health and safety risk, and it just got torn down.
Yeah. Okay, so I think the gate still has some reference down to the gateway to the memorial aspect of it, but by that time, the basic activities were going on in the square. And in terms of the image on the left, there's actually history to be written, I think, of military parades and their nature in a city like Palmerston North, where they were held, the way that the square, Te Marae Ohine, was utilised for parading, and of course that history of the railway line, with this, you know, bend in the middle where once the memorial was in place, the railway line had to be bent to accommodate it. So the geography of the city is something I think would need to be in a chapter on the city at war. On the left there, the Māori Battalion, a photo from the Auckland Weekly. And on the right, the interior of the Māori Battalion Hall. So we do mention the hall and its designer and some of the meaning around the images and the statues on the inside. The photo on the left, incidentally, is headed "A Fine Body of Men." In terms of the chapter on education, the little boys, I think it's a photo taken in the 1900s of boys at Terracine School, just won a competition for marksmanship, and boys trained at school and of course in their own families to shoot things, to be good marksmen. And I suspect some of them have very good long distance eyesight, more so than the generation that spends their time looking at a computer screen like me. So for little boys, marksmanship was a key skill for survival. And on the other side, on the right, we've got Massey students on marching against the Vietnam War. And it wasn't actually a stump that put them in very good odour with the local civilians, because I think it followed a, Helen Dorry will be able to put me right on this, followed an actual process. But they sort of went a step too far by pouring themselves in pig's blood and, you know, marching around dripping blood, and, you know, that didn't go down too well with the local people. So these are other ways in which a city at war, one would need to explore protest and also pacifism as part of that story, those who opposed war as well. So I think there's two lenses one could put on this, and Leanne will be talking more about one of them. If we were writing about a city at war, we'd be focusing on things predominantly, I think, on the home front and civilian activity, but we'd also have to be aware of the civilians who were went into uniform and volunteered in wartime. We'd be looking at things like patriotism and xenophobia, and that's where I'd be using some of Simon Johnson's work on the Boer War and First World War, where he explored the sort of perhaps the more extreme versions of patriotism. We'd be looking at pacifism and protest, and that would include some of Margaret Tate's work on the camps, the conscientious objectors camps, but also on pacifists like Mark Briggs. We'd be looking at protest and the various, particularly against the Vietnam War, but to see if there were any other form of public protest in other war situations. I'd be particularly interested in the economic impact of both war, but also of the military presence in more recent years, and government policies and how they played out in Palmerston North in wartime, the manpowering restrictions, blackouts and so on. In the longer term, there's a very interesting story still to be written, I think, about the impact of the military basis on the economics of the city, on the employment patterns that I mentioned before, and demographics, because the fact that we have a military camp nearby, which is now part of the city, means we've actually, it's contributed to the idea of Palmerston North having statistically a relatively young population compared with some other provincial cities. If I was writing about the military history of the city, I'd start very much from what we now call the Hickman chronology, and Leanne's going to talk about that more. We would talk about things like early militia and rifle corps, not just the boys, but you know the men who formed rifle brigades and so on. We're looking at recruitment and appeal processes in wartime. I think, Leanne, some of the statistics are on a Wellington province level rather than a city one. So I tried at one point to get a sense of appeals against conscription and how one could explore that, but most of the data seem to be on a provincial rather than a city level. We'd be looking at soldiers, we're looking at death rates compared with other places. We'd be looking at the stories of individuals and how families were affected. We'd be looking at military training, both the Medical Corps, World War I, and Maori Battalion, World War II, and other camps. And the notion of the importance of the defence sector and the idea that's more recently been promulgated of the defence city. The inscription upon the landscape, both the labelling of streets, but memorials, and what I mentioned before, the railway line, how it actually had a bend in it to accommodate a memorial. And the relations of the defence bases with council and city, both positive and negative interactions. And I must say here, say the labelling of the streets, the Poppy Streets things, as a historian, I'd be interested in the process by which that came about. So someone like Joe would be featuring just as much as the dead heroes who are mentioned on the street names. So there's different lenses that we put on this, and this is where I think I hand over to Leanne, who'll be talking a bit more about this notion of the military history of the city.
Okay, so as has been mentioned, a few years ago I was commissioned to do a chronology of the military history of Palmerston North, and the idea of that was to show the people, places and events that encompass the military history of Palmerston North, and also provide a bibliography that was the sources specific to Palmerston North for the military history. It was a few years ago, so possibly needs a second edition now with my new knowledge. And also, I only went as far as the Vietnam War, so it does need to be extended out to the modern day. That was purely a time thing. So what I'm going to talk about today is the military history from about 1860, but as Margaret mentioned, if you're interested in pre-European Māori activities, there's a fantastic book to check, which has a lovely chapter on tangata whenua. But in the context of the 1860s, Palmerston North was very concerned about the land wars coming down to this area, And so there was quite a few volunteer military units established. That didn't happen, and then they didn't really have much to do, so many of them were disbanded. However, in 1879, the Palmerston North Rifles were formed. They were later known as C Company No. 2 Battalion, Wellington West Coast Rifle Volunteers. And George Snelson was their first captain, who was also the first mayor of Palmerston North, the first shopkeeper, pretty much the first everything of Palmerston North. And James Carroll was afterwards elected captain of that unit up until 1891. They had a minimum membership of 60, sorry, a minimum membership of 50, and there was usually about 60 members of the Palmerston North Rifles. In 1891, the Manawatu Mounted Rifles were formed as a volunteer cavalry unit. Their captain was Major Charles Dunk, and he later became mayor in 1902. So these volunteer units, generally the people heading them, were prominent figures in Palmerston North. In 1899, the Boer War began, and local men did volunteer to participate, including members of the Palmerston North Rifles and the Manawatu Mounted Rifles. But apart from the Boer War, there wasn't a great deal of military activity going on, so they didn't have a huge amount to do. So they engaged in a lot of demonstrations and military tournaments. And one of the key military tournaments from 1906 was the tournament around the King's Birthday. And that was always at the showgrounds. I had to find an engineers for you. During the 1907 tournament, the activities included artillery display by D Battery, and the Manawatu Mounted Rifles gave an exhibition of lance exercises, which was the first of its kind. The military tournaments continued to be an annual event until the King's death in 1910, and then they started in a different form. Now, what's less talked about is the Wellington Military District Headquarters, which moved to Palmerston North on the 3rd of March 1911, so actually well before the First World War. And it was under the command of Major General Sir Edward Chater, which is Chater Street. Palmerston North was thought to be really well centrally located, had excellent railway connections. The Wellington Military District encompassed Wellington, Manawatu, Taranaki and the Hawke's Bay. That also included Wairarapa and Poverty Bay. And so we were very much, we were the borough at that time, but borough at the centre. And also Palmerston North was away from the coast, so it meant it wasn't prone to coastal enemy attack like Wellington was. The headquarters were located originally around where Crombie Lockwood Rebel Sports is now, and then it moved in 1915 to number 70 Main Street. The Wellington Military District authorities leased the Awapuni Racecourse on the 13th of August 1914 and became a temporary military training ground. It began receiving men from the East Coast, Taranaki, Hawke's Bay, Wairarapa, Manawatu and Wellington. By the 25th of August, 81 officers and 2,680 men were based there. On that same day, 19-year-old gunner Ludolf Edward Wynne West died of pneumonia at Awapuni Camp. It was just 3 days after war was declared. He was accorded a full military funeral, which you can see here, and just on the left there you can see the gates to Terracine Cemetery. And on the 25th of August 2006, he was officially recognised as New Zealand's first casualty of World War I. Some people debate that, at a ceremony at his graveside at Terracine Cemetery. After 6 weeks of training, the men at Awapuni Racecourse left for Wellington on the 22nd of September 1914. During the 6 weeks, 4,198 men passed through the camp. making it the biggest camp in New Zealand at that time, and many of those men went on to fight at Gallipoli. And Valbuer suggests that Anzac Park was named with those men that had been at that camp at that time, who went on to die at Gallipoli. So I'm going to look at a little bit at the Medical Corps camp. And last year, some of you may know that I talked about the Medical Corps camp in connection with the influenza pandemic. So I'm going to talk a little bit about that because it's the anniversary at the moment. So a training camp for the New Zealand Medical Corps was opened at Awapuni Racecourse on the 6th of October 1915. And this replaced the haphazard medical training program carried out at Trentham. 350 to 400 Army medical personnel were based there at any given time. And in this picture, you can see on the right, Major Arthur Anderson Martin. And he was a surgeon at Palmerston North Hospital, and he's well known as being a leader in the medical community in Palmerston North, and he died at the Somme. And if you go to Palmerston North Hospital, there's the big memorial plaque to him just down the hallway. So that's him on the right, on the bottom. So, and there's some of the men training at Awapuni Camp. Now, in about the end of October 1918, one of the soldiers was away in Auckland for rest and recreation, and he came back to Awapuni Medical Corps Camp, and he brought a friend with him, the influenza virus. By the 3rd of November, the influenza outbreak spread through Awapuni Camp. The advantage of Awapuni Camp is that they were able to quarantine themselves. Nobody was allowed to come in. Any leave was extended. And anybody in the camp, they were not allowed to leave. So the camp was able to quarantine themselves. And they did get a lot of support from the Palmerston North community. The Palmerston North Red Cross helped supply them with goods and materials that they couldn't get from the army stores. But they actually got, the thing with the flu virus is it reaches a peak and then it very quickly goes away. So by the 15th of November, the quarantine was able to be lifted at Awapuni Camp, and that meant they were able to help out in the Palmerston North community. The problem in Palmerston North was the virus was spreading like wildfire. The cases had skyrocketed to 2,000 individuals were sick, and the hospitals were completely overwhelmed. But with the Awapuni Medical Corps camp, there was a ready supply of medical personnel ready to go. There was one other small problem that helped spread the virus in Palmerston North, and that was the 11th of November 1918. The declaration of the end of the war meant that people just spontaneously came out and celebrated. It couldn't be stopped. This is one of the images from that day. And the problem with that, the virus was already in Palmerston North, but it hadn't reached the outer districts. So this event spread it to the rural regions. The virulence of the infection meant that people were stuck in bed, they couldn't leave their homes, so they needed supplies taken to them. The hospital was absolutely bursting, so orderlies from Awapuni Camp assisted the nurses throughout the main hospital and were reported to be doing good work. Lieutenant Colonel Gebites was the head of Awapuni Camp at the time, and on the 18th of November he sent six men to prepare and disinfect a new children's hospital. Now this wasn't necessarily for children who were sick, but it was also for children whose parents were sick and they couldn't take care of them. Cap- Captain Ford of the New Zealand Medical Corps Ordnance Department provided 20 beds and mattresses. The work had begun at 2 o'clock and by 4:30 p.m. a number of children were placed in the wards. The next day, 26 children and many more infants were under the care of Nurse Tingey and her assistants, including staff of the New Zealand Medical Corps. And there's a lovely quote that says, "Midnight finds a solitary soldier in charge of these babies. He hushes the piteous cry of one, mixes the bottle for another one, and bestows all necessary attention on the poor little sufferer, giving them almost maternal care. Nothing spectacular about it, but it is the work that is helping with this war for health and peace." On the 25th of November, the Soldiers Club had been established as a temporary hospital, and it was in full charge of the New Zealand Medical Corps. And you see from this picture, it kind of encompasses that community effort with the doctors, the staff of the New Zealand Medical Corps, volunteer nurses, and Boy Scouts who helped going out to people's homes taking supplies. Which as a mum, I'm like, I'm not sure I would have wanted my children doing that, but that's okay. Now, I mentioned that there was a big problem with the surrounding communities. The influenza virus spread to those places a little bit later. And so Danny Verkin was particularly hard hit and was left without any medical care because the local doctors and nurses all succumbed to the influenza virus. So Awapuni Camp sent out four orderlies to help at Dannevirke on the 18th of November. And then they sent out four more orderlies on the 21st as the situation continued to escalate. Per head of population, Dannevirke was one of the hardest hit. They also sent medical students from Dunedin to go and help in some of those rural places as well. Awapuni Camp also sent orderlies to help in Ashurst and on the 29th of November, and a few days earlier a call had come from Rongatea who were desperate for ambulance men. So Lieutenant Colonel Gebites drove three over to Rongatea himself and spoke to the local committee to help with arrangements. A small cottage hospital was open with Awapuni men doing good work. The following day, Gebites and Councillor Frederick Nathan visited Taikaria and Glen Arua. Back in Palmerston North, to ease the pressure on the overflowing hospitals, so that's the main hospital plus the hospital at the Soldiers Club, they decided to open a convalescent hospital at the Technical College. And so Lieutenant Colonel Gebites, Dr. Edgar Whittaker and Captain George Spence, who was the quartermaster of Awapuni Camp, went over and made sure that was all set up. The beds were organised and a sitting room was kitted out under the direction of Captain Spence. A call went out for 12 woman volunteers to work at the home, and once again the home was placed under the charge of the New Zealand Medical Corps, as had been the Soldiers Club. Finally, by the 3rd of December, the influenza cases were rapidly decreasing. So again, hit a peak, and it actually quite quickly went away. Sadly, that's not the experience of this current pandemic. The bulk of the new cases in the hospitals were from country districts, and the majority of the patients were now convalescing. On the 4th of December 1929, the Awapuni Memorial was unveiled at the Awapuni Racecourse. The memorial was a tribute to the fallen soldiers of the New Zealand Medical Corps. From 2014, the neglected memorial underwent restoration and was unveiled at a special ceremony on the 20th of October 2016 with a formal military service. So I'm just going to talk a little bit about the showgrounds, which is topical for us at the moment as it's undergoing redevelopment. So from the 1914, the showgrounds were used as a remount depot and then used at regular intervals as a stopover for men going to various other camps. peace celebrations marking the end of World War I, the official ones, were held on the 19th of July 1919, and military groups paraded around the square and speeches were conducted at the showgrounds. And you can see on the far right, there's a little figure of Mayor James Nash there. Overall, a crowd of about 7,000 packed the showgrounds. Similarly, during the Second World War, the showgrounds was also often used as a stopover for soldiers travelling to other centres, such as Wellington. And I've got exactly the same picture as Margaret because it's awesome. The 28th Māori Battalion was formed as part of the 2nd New Zealand Division, the fighting arm of the 2nd New Zealand Expeditionary Force during the Second World War. Major George Dittman was appointed commanding officer. On the 25th of January 1940, the battalion first assembled at the Palmerston North Showgrounds. For military training, which continued for 3 months. On the 2nd of May 1940, the 28th Māori Battalion marched to the Palmerston North Railway Station for embarkation. Huge crowds gathered to farewell the soldiers. 681 men sailed from Wellington with the second echelon of the 2nd New Zealand Expeditionary Force aboard the famous luxury liner, the Aquitania. Okay, we're doing okay. I'm just going to look a little bit at Massey. In 1939, a college troop of the Manawatu Mounted Rifles was formed at Massey Agricultural College by the college principal, Brigadier Geoffrey Pearn. That's him there, I believe. And because that was made up of staff and students from the college, it meant that rifles, Bren guns and ammunition were stored at the college. The Army Staff Training College officially opened at Massey in November 1941. The college trained up to 200 commanding officers and the same number of staff officers each year for the Home Defence Forces. The Pink Hostel, which is now McCarty Hall, was constructed specifically for use by the Army College. In May 1944, the first class of farm trainees under the government's rehabilitation scheme for return soldiers began at Massey. The course lasted 28 weeks and there were nearly 30 ex-servicemen students. And Massey continued to offer various short courses for return servicemen. And there's a research project in that for somebody, which Jeff keeps wanting us to do. From the beginning of November 1941, Keisha Birch House was used as an accommodation facility for the directing staff of the New Zealand Army Staff Training College at Massey. The house could accommodate 47 people. To house the Army staff, the property required extensive improvement to the house and, at that time, its neglected grounds. By the 31st of March 1944, the prospect of invasion had reduced, and the home defence was demobilised and officers were no longer required. The army vacated Massey and Keisha Birch House on the 31st of March 1944. The official opening of a convalescent home based at Keisha Birch House took place on the 20th of May 1946. The home was for the Sisters of the New Zealand Army Nurses Service, the WAC and the WAFs, to convalesce from illness and injury. It later also received all trained nurses and trainees for any part of New Zealand, but priority was given to the service woman. I'm just going to finish at the end of 1945 with the fire. A huge fire swept through the showgrounds buildings on New Year's Day, 1945. There was a heavy loss of Army ordnance stores. The Army had used the buildings at the showgrounds for storage for several years as part of the military installations at the showgrounds. The estimated cost of the losses was as high as £1 million. So £1 million, 1945, it was devastating. I'm going to finish there. There is a lot more detail in the chronology of various people, places and events, and it's available on Manawatu Heritage. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Leanne and Margaret. Fascinating history, isn't it? A lot of people don't realise how much of a military history that Palmerston North does have. And I see Peter Wood there scribbling frantically, because Peter's going to talk to us next year about military units and the Manawatu Mounted Rifles and those military units that originated from Palmerston North. So that'll be another fascinating talk. Margaret mentioned the poppy places around Palmerston North, of which we have 31 in the city and another 35 streets out in Linton Camp, of which six were commemorated yesterday, and we had 11 launched last year. So we've still got another 18 to go over the next few years. But they are all related to you know, key individuals within the military or key campaigns, battles over the years. And in fact, if you go on the New Zealand Poppy Place Trust website, you'll see that the histories of all of those streets that are shown both here and in Palmerston North and in Linton Camp are already up online. And for those that were at the launch yesterday, you would have heard the history of some of those six streets at Linton that were launched yesterday. There's some really incredible information in there. The other thing to mention, well, obviously there's another book in the writing, isn't there? When's that one coming out, Margaret?
But you're in danger of being in it, you see. We've got to
start some good. No, I need to do something about it. For those that are interested, this is the book that Margaret Lee edited with her colleagues, City at the Centre, that was launched a week or two ago. And this covers the material that Margaret gave in her presentation. So this is available, a sales plug from Bruce McKenzie, booksellers downstairs, if you want a copy. I've had a wee read, and it is quite fascinating. There's some really interesting information in there. So we now come time for questions. Do any of you have any questions for either Margaret or Leanne on the presentation? Oh, the stud.
Excellent.
Absolutely. And we haven't even got to lunchtime yet.
What was in the military store, Leanne? Was it just uniforms or...?
Yeah, weapons? So it's things like your tents, your uniforms, blankets. There was no firepower.
No ammunition or firepower there. Munitions.
But there was obviously a lot of it. A
heap of stuff.
Yeah, a heap of stuff that was being distributed around to the various camps around New Zealand.
Bedding, blankets, clothing... You know, typical ordnance stores, Basins, IG, I mean, you know, just think about it. Anybody who served in the military, you know what ordnance stores are about. There were no field defences or field defence stores, and thank goodness there was no ammunition or pyrotechnics or anything like that, because that would have put a big hole in the centre of Palmerston North.
Yeah, exactly.
But I mean, you know, when you think about it, £1 million worth of ordnance stores in those days, you can imagine what the value of that would be today. That's a huge amount of ordnance.
40,
stores.
50 million?
Oh, at least. But when you just think about the magnitude of that material, it would have been incredible.
That's what I keep thinking. It must have been such a lot of stuff in there, centred in that one place.
And a hell of a fire. Yep.
And a hell of a fire.
I understand there was wool stored in that store. And was that that caused the fire and that bad explains how high?
Oh, okay. So there might have been in an adjacent building. And they've got, you know, what do they call it? Automatic, you know, immediate combustion or something.
Yeah.
Sorry, there's somebody else.
My father's brothers and cousins and all that did time in the infantry at Awabuni for the medical corps. There's a monument for the medical corps there, but there's no recognition of the infantry and the time that they spent there. No. They spent so long there, and then my uncles and cousins then went on to Trentham.
To Featherston or Trentham?
To Trentham. I think it was Trentham.
Yeah.
Yes.
My understanding is that
Anzac Park was named, and this is Valber's research, that Anzac Park was named specifically with that camp in mind, because a lot of those soldiers went off to war and were killed that were in that camp, because there's like 4,000 in that camp. But you're right, there isn't a specific memorial for those soldiers.
And of course, Memorial Park is a memorial for World War II
folk.
And as I mentioned yesterday, there is a research project that is just in operation here with the heritage section, where we're looking at all of those soldiers and nurses, sailors, the whole nine yards, from Palmerston North and the immediate area, who made the ultimate sacrifice from the Boer War, South African wars, to the present day. Now, we know that 1,069 were killed during World War I from Palmerston North, and I think we're just working our way through the figures, but there's something like another 400-odd in World War II. And so overall, the total is just under 2,000. So, you know, it's quite significant. And when you look at the number of memorials around Palmerston North, and there's another piece of work that the City Council are doing and looking at the protection and management of all of our memorials and sculptures and the like, and that'll come out next year to make sure it goes into the district plan, otherwise that all gets lost. But as far as World War I is concerned, it's basically the Medical Corps at Awapuni, the remainder at Anzac Park, World War II as Memorial Park, and then the whole raft of other individual memorials scattered around the city.
Mm-hmm.
Other questions? Yeah, Tony.
I can remember as an 8-year-old in Glenn, 1940, a convoy, vehicle convoy leaving, and a lot of the local businesses contributed their vehicles, and I wondered whether that occurred here. And like the local Chinaman, he contributed his vehicle and delivered by bicycle from that time onwards.
I'm absolutely sure there was a lot of civilian groups and businesses who contributed in various ways to what they saw as, you know, the bigger war effort. And I think that'd be one of the really interesting things to tease out, is the degree of community engagement and the very minute ways in which some people often felt they were doing their bit.
Mm.
Yeah. I think, you know, there's a wonderful story to be told on that. And the actual incredible community buy-in.
Yes.
Isn't it?
Bombs for bombs.
Yes. And, you know, money to buy an aeroplane and things like that. So that was...
We also had the train in the middle of the city, so they didn't have to kind of stomp off
to
far-flung places. Or they just had to march to the train stations. So it was pretty easy. But yeah, certainly other ways that the community contributed. Yeah.
Any other questions? Comments, contributions?
That marksmanship for young men was still in operation in the late 1940s, because I was marched down to the Main Street headquarters for rifle shooting.
Oh, and the old 25-metre, you know, the back there. Yeah. But I mean, a lot of school cadet units were still operating here, and I mean, there still is.
Right,
at Palmerston North Boys High, they have a defence academy. QEC, I think, still has a military academy. Are there any others there? Or is that about it now?
Yeah, QEC is the main one.
All right, well, look, I think we'll probably draw it to a close there. So once again, can you please thank Leanne and Margaret for a very interesting presentation. And obviously, there is another book in the writing, and also...
I'm quite ready to corral a group of historians again.
Well, you know, we've got Jeff, so but look, the other thing I just wanted to do also, given that this is our last presentation for 2020, and it has been a fairly disrupted sort of a year, but we have managed to have some excellent topics and presentations this year. And as I said, a grateful thanks to Stuart Burks up front here. Stuart's recorded all of them and all
all of those audios are now up on the engineer website. So there are a number of different sites that you need to visit if you're interested in some of these things, like the Poppy Places site, the engineer website, and so on. Next year, we've got a full program. We'll resume activity on the 11th of February, but we'll put that program up on the website, bring it in here to the City Library, so that you'll know what's on the program and the invitation thing. Yeah.
Just quickly, my next research project is based around the military organisation of the showgrounds during the Napier earthquake. So if anybody's got information about particularly how that was organised, let me know.
Yeah, I mean, that's an interesting point that Leanne raises. Many of us have been involved with the consultants dealing with the heritage aspect of the redevelopment of the arena. And there's a huge amount of history material, both military and other history, of the showgrounds from all the time that Leanne was presenting there, way back to the time of the South African Wars or before then.
Yeah.
And that'll all be built into a lot of displays and artwork at the showgrounds. So that'll get launched in, is it May next year, I think?
Yeah, somewhere. Something like that.
Yeah,
so
April or May. So you'll see a lot of the stuff that was being talked about today with respect to the showgrounds actually becoming a reality next year.
Yeah, so I'm trying to connect my research to the opening of the showgrounds, the military organisation, and the 90th anniversary of the Hawke's Bay earthquake. So it kind of brings those three threads together, which is really nice.
All right, well, look, thanks very much, and thank you all for your support during the course of the year. We'll see you next year. Have a great Christmas.